Hi, listeners. Stories have so much power, and so does whoever controls the narrative. It is time that we dissect and analyze these stories. I am Vipul, and this is Woke Tales. The relationship between religion and homosexuality has varied greatly across time and place, within and between different religions and denominations. Historically, some cultures and religions accommodated, institutionalized, or revered same-sex love and sexuality. Such mythologies and traditions can be found around the world. Today's story is the story of the rabbit god, a Chinese mythology. But before we get to the story, I want to introduce Dr. Orr Parath. Dr. Parath is a postdoc scholar at the University of Chicago. Hi, Dr. Parath. Welcome to the show.
Hi, hello. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining. Can you tell us a little bit about your research background?
Sure. So I'm a postdoctoral researcher in the Department of East Asian Languages and Civilizations at University of Chicago. I work mainly in the field of Buddhist studies, and I have broad interests in East Asian religions, the history of gender and sexuality, and monasticism. I look specifically into Japanese religions, their doctrines, practices, and the intersection between Buddhist worldviews and issues of gender and sexuality. Right now, I'm currently writing a book on a ritual from medieval Japan from the 1500s and the 1400s called Chigo Kanjo, the consecration of acolytes. And that was a medieval male-male sexual rite of passage that was doctrinally supported by Orthodox Buddhist teachings. Probably one of the only examples in the world, as far as I know.
Wow, that sounds really interesting. And good luck with your book. Do you already have a timeline for when it is going to be ready, or is it in very initial phase?
Oh, you should ask about that. I mean,
No,
I'm joking. I'm working on it. There are a few chapters written. I have a little bit more to write from now onward, but it's halfway done.
Right. No, that's great. And good luck with that. Yeah. And I should have known better when I was writing my PhD thesis. I think every time someone asked me how much is done, I would be like, oh,
right,
my God.
Right. Academics don't usually like to think about it. But, you know, eventually we write the book and it's over and we're happy.
Absolutely. So your research expertise in East Asian religion and gender and sexuality make you the perfect person to dissect and analyze today's story with me. So without further ado, it's story time. Tuershan is a deity in Chinese folklore who manages the love and sex between homosexual men. His name literally means rabbit deity. According to the Tale of the Rabbit God, written by scholar and poet Yan Mei, Tuershan was originally a man named Hu Tianbao, who fell in love with a very handsome, young imperial inspector in 18th century Fujian province during the early Qing dynasty. However, because of the inspector's higher status, Hu was afraid to reveal his feelings. One day, Hu was caught peeping at the inspector's bare derriere through a gap in the bathroom wall when the latter went to the toilet, at which point Hu confessed his reluctant affection for other men. The imperial inspector was outraged and had him sentenced to death by beating for offending a nobleman. 1 month after Hu's death, he is said to have appeared to an elder from his hometown in a dream, claiming that since his crime was one of love, King Yama, ruler of the Chinese Hades, have decided to redress the injustice by appointing him the rabbit god. As such, his duty was to govern the affairs of men who desire men. In the dream, he asked the man to erect a shrine to him. When he awoke, the elder obliged by exhorting the fellow village folk to raise money to erect a temple to Hu Tianbao and name it the Rabbit God Temple. In return, the Rabbit God responded to his adherents' prayers without disappointment. Yan Mei mentioned that people who had underground love affairs, secret agreements, and unattainable desires could visit the Rabbit God Temple. The shrine to Hu Tianbao became very popular in Fujian province, so much so that in late Qing times, the cult of Hu Tianbao was suppressed by the homophobic Qing government. A slang term for homosexuals in late imperial China was toots, which is why Hu Tianbao is referred to as the rabbit god. Even today, his devotees portray him with rabbit ears and make offerings of carrots to his altars. The handsome statuette in this image is lovingly clothed in a rabbit fur cloak. While no one knows if the gays in mainland China worship him, there is a temple in Yonggachi City in Taiwan that venerates Hu Tianbao, alias Tuershen. The temple is known as the Rabbit Temple. So Dr. Porath, what are your initial thoughts and are you familiar with this story?
Well, I was familiar with it because there was an article written in 1998 by Professor Michael Zonyi from Harvard University. And that article kind of made a ripple effect in the study of the history of homosexuality in China and then in East Asia more broadly, because we have one of the first examples in recent time for a religious group in China, right? Specifically here in 18th century Fuzhou, where men who wanted to engage in sexual liaisons with boys basically practiced religious devotion to a deity. There aren't many ritualization of male sexuality or the enshrinement of certain gods as male sexual gods. So in that article, it provided a lot of evidence for this religious group that worshipped Hu Tianbao. And really, after that, a whole range of studies were conducted about all kinds of aspects in the history of male sexuality in Qing Dynasty China, in Ming Dynasty China, and then at the same time, there were also really important studies about Japan. So this is really the golden age of academia where people start talking about male sexuality as a worthy object of study in Asian studies, more specifically.
So if I ask you about the association between East Asian religion and queerness, how do you think the religion views queerness, given that there was a deity specifically for same-sex couples? And has it changed over time now that there are studies on the topic and people are reading religious texts and books with a modern lens and probably different interpretations?
Right. So I hope my answer will not be too long because there's too much to talk about here. But, you know, there are multiple religions in East Asia, right? If we just talk about China and Japan, just to limit the discussion, we have Buddhism, which is a foreign religion, but it became very popular and entrenched in both China and Japan. In Buddhism, of course, human desire is the root of all suffering. Mm-hmm. Desire is, in many texts, Buddhist sutras is described as a scorching flame that envelops all of us and makes us cling to objects. So the idea in Buddhism is that we are all imprisoned in this cycle of birth and rebirth, and desire ties us even further to that, right? And the goal is to transcend this cycle and become a Buddha. So really what you have to do in Buddhism is to uproot desire, which releases you from endless suffering. And sexual desire is one of the worst things out of all desires. It's certainly not the worst, but it's pretty bad. Simply because when you desire things and then they lead to pleasure, the greater the pleasure, the stronger the imprint it leaves on you. And then you seek desire all over again. And so sexual desire is especially problematic and intense. It produces intense pleasure, what we call orgasm, right? Mm-hmm. So Buddhism always regarded sensual desire as dangerous, but it was not the only desire. There's desire for food, there's thirst, greed, yearning for material things. So I think it's a little bit misleading to just focus on sexual desire as the worst thing, but definitely it's there, it comes up. And the sexual acts, which is really the acting upon sensual desire, for monks in Buddhism, it's considered the most serious offense. So technically, you know, according to the text, you're not supposed to engage in sexual acts at all. It doesn't matter whether it's gay, queer. But the reality is different. Japanese today, you know, they can marry women, they can have children. And Chinese society as well persistently devalues celibacy because there's this ethos of having children, of worshipping the ancestors. So rejecting sex is something that can break the line of descent So they never really went with it altogether, right? So our first point of departure is that Buddhism certainly, especially in Japan, already involves sex, even if you're a monk. In China, not if you're a monk, but historically they had difficulty getting rid of sex. Now, where does queerness fall within all of this? If you look at the actual text that many Buddhists nowadays read, the Buddhist monastic code, right, they're called Vinaya in Sanskrit. There's actually an outstanding diversity of sexed and gendered beings. I don't know how to call them otherwise. I mean, we could call them people that have queer erotic desire. So you have a group of people that we can retroactively call queers. They're called Pandaka in Sanskrit. And they encompassed a wide range of individuals, including, I'll give you a few examples, passive male homosexual, somebody who's suffering from genital abnormality, so sounds like intersex, men who lacked penises, sexless beings. So these kind of people are mentioned a lot, and of course they were looked down upon. They couldn't be ordained into the Buddhist community. But the interesting thing is that Buddhists, in many, many Buddhist communities today, people read this material. So they read about hermaphrodites who can change their genitals. They read about sexual fluidity, basically. They read about voyeurs, something that sounds kinky, or people that are attracted to men only for a short time. So even though they are basically abhorred in the text, if you read the Buddhist precepts, you see that in terms of sexuality and gender norms, heterosexuality is not the norm at all. You see that human beings are attracted to all sexes, you see fluidity in gender. So same-sex acts are considered immoral, but they are treated as something natural that just happens. It's not like Christianity, where there is the old age argument that homosexuality is against nature, right? Mm-hmm. In Latin, contra naturam. So the official position actually in Buddhism, if you look at these Vinaya texts, is that queer desire is normal. But if it impinges of heterosexual intercourse, then it becomes problematic, right? So it has to be some sort of a side project. Okay. So as long as it doesn't completely replace heterosexual longing, it's fine.
This is so interesting because now we talk about spectrum of sexuality and terms like pansexuality, which is just like you said, about attraction towards people regardless to sex and gender identity. And also we talk about gender being a social construct, and you mentioned the presence of gender fluidity in Buddhism. So I feel there is a lot of common ground on this topic between then and now. But everyone knows that acceptance and embracement is still not 100%. So what is your take on how things have changed over time, and what is the stance today?
There are places like in Thailand, I remember that I think it was in 2003, for example, the Thai Buddhist Association, based on certain Buddhist texts and scripture, basically condemned homosexuality. You know, so you have conservative figures here and there in different Asian countries, but really homosexuality have come a long way. In Taiwan, of course, this is a famous example. Taiwan legalized gay marriage in 2019. And in Japan, there's an overwhelming acceptance of homosexuality, about 68%. And in terms of Buddhism, you know, even in China, which we tend to think is a little bit less welcoming because they legalized homosexuality in 97, homosexual acts, there was still a gay Buddhist group in the 90s that was just dedicated to LGBTQ. They were called Child Brahman Abode. And, you know, I can keep going on. I know you have all kinds of examples. The head of the biggest Buddhist temple in Taiwan, Fo Guangshan, said 20 years ago that Buddhist ethics do not consider homosexuality as a sin, that there can be practice. So I think this is the general line of thought. In Japan, there's for the first time, they built a few years ago next to Osaka, a temple only for LGBTQ community, and the abbot is a transgender nun. Now, this is certainly not the normal situation, right? I don't want to over exaggerate that, you know, LGBTQ are accepted everywhere. There's still a pretty much, you know, there are legal problems, there are issues of discrimination. But slowly we're beginning to see that Buddhist communities are accepting a more progressive position on this issue.
So it used to be normal, maybe not ideal, but still accepted and considered normal and natural. And now the stance is also somewhat progressive, but seems like somewhere in the middle, the societal norms and traditions got mixed up with the religion.
And I guess they kind of amalgamated, and I guess that's when the queer population felt more excluded or discriminated against.
Right, and that the traditional kind of morality and system of ethics in China is Confucianism, right? It's not Buddhism. Mm-hmm. And so what you're talking about is a sort of local or more familial tradition that somehow got in the way here that comes from Confucianism, where there's a very strong ethical role in the family, and gender and sexuality is defined in familial terms. You know, women have to become wives and mothers, and because there is a focus on ancestral worship, sons were expected to continue the family line. So, you know, there's not, in that particular system, there is no room for gender diversity or homosexual, lesbian intercourse. I mean, if only if it's done on the side, not as a way of life, right? If you were not, you know, being gay or lesbian means that you're engaging in non-reproductive sexual acts. So there isn't going to be a birth of a child. This is a general problem that people experience nowadays. Although I should say that China is no longer that Confucian. I mean, there's a whole debate about how much Confucian China is. Of course, there are different ideologies of the state, right? There's communism, there's all kinds of other strands of thought. But there is this still a very strong familial-based family unit, right? And homosexuality seems harmful to it. So yeah, it's a problem. It's a problem from a Confucian perspective or from a Chinese traditional perspective.
I think responsibility or the desire for a lineage or family name or line is not necessarily just important in Chinese society. I think it is everywhere, in every society. And sometimes that can be one of the big factors in parental acceptance as well.
Yeah, that's definitely everywhere. It's just a little bit worse in China, because the family unit was seen as owing duty and obligation to the state. So the harmony of the family automatically somehow projects to the well-being of the state, projects onto the well-being of the state. So there is this organic relationship. And so there's a lot in stake here when you're risking the integrity of the family. Right. That's what conservative would say, and you know, more traditionalist people would say. But I definitely agree. I mean, I come from Israel, and you know, one of the reasons homosexuality in Israel is thriving is because a lot of gay people are having children, you know, 2-3 children. And so it's not perceived as a real risk. It doesn't hurt the family at all. It perpetuates the lineage of the family.
So I come from India, and the whole family and community close-knit setup is quite important as well. So guess not just East Asia, but the whole Southeast Asia. And this next generation can be a big concern in those countries and communities. I do want to mention that it's great that Taiwan has decriminalized homosexuality. And a few years ago, India did as well, so it's a great step towards equality.
Taiwan legalized gay marriage.
Oh, gay marriage. That's okay. Yeah. That's another step further. So
they're really ahead of everyone in Asia.
Right. So I think other Asian countries to follow suit. So
let's hope that there will be a beacon to other nations in this regard.
Preach. So we're talking about family, community, and society. So another topic which comes when we talk about society, and I'm bringing this back to the story, is the hierarchy, class system. In the story, the rank inspector is mentioned, and there was a comment about not wanting to offend the nobleman. So it seems like, apart from the whole attraction towards same sex, there is element of class difference. But in the end of the story, the village people raised the funds for the temple. So I don't know if I'm applying this correctly or not, but to me it seems like the acceptance level was variable depending on your rank in the society, between common people and the higher class.
So yeah, this is a very important question. I think we should first think about, when we try to interpret this myth, first we need to ask, what was the crime, right, that was committed by Hu Tianbao? So he was peeping and looking at the bum of another person, right? So was it the male-male erotic desire that was the crime? Was it the voyeurism, right? The fact that he peeped? Or is it about class or undermining social hierarchy? I think if you read it carefully, you can see that it's not really about homoerotic longing, but rather, as you implied or said clearly, it's about offending and shaming an official, right? A person of a higher level. Now, Hu Tianbao is actually not from a very low background. I think he's an upper class person, but still, he is not an official. So you have a situation when a person of lower rank catches an official in the act of defecation. We could also think about it as invasion of privacy, maybe. Actually, you know, I looked at another translation, and I think there it's a little bit clear what was the crime. If I may quote, it says in the other version, "Because of my feelings, which violated propriety, I offended an honorable man." So he says, it is the feelings are to be blamed. I think it's more of a rhetorical statement, you know, all I did was love, right? But really what I did was violating propriety. So he also another sense is deviating from social, accepted social norm, which is probably related to impinging or catching the official in his act of defecation, right? So he basically transgressed the proper boundaries between his own rank and the rank of the other person. He invaded his privacy. So it's not the feelings, right? Even though some people may be tempted to highlight the feelings or the homoeroticism. And so let me get back to the class thing. As you said, there is a clear hierarchical divide here. You were mentioning the fact that the people were the ones that building the temple, right? So I think that there is a sort of a hierarchical structure in the story where first you have a case of human deification, not defecation, right? I mean apotheosis, right? Elevation into godhood, right? So Hu Tianbao becomes a god, right? So you have a human deification that provides social mobility, right? Hu Tianbao basically becomes higher than anyone else after. So actually his deification rectified his wrongdoing by adjusting his position within the pre-existing social order. And then you have the elder. Again, it's about class and rank, right? The elder of the community, who's the highest person in the social ladder. And he's the one who approves the building of the temple. And then, as you mentioned, the people themselves build the temple, finally. And of course, no official is involved with the construction of the temple. At the time, it was very common to ask local communities to raise money, and then the people would raise money through begging and, you know, the help of mendicants and so forth, and then the temple would be erected. But basically, there is this structure of here of power being trickled down, right, from the highest authority, the rabbit god, to the lowest village community, right? So it's kind of like an inversion of the original situation in the story, when Hu Tianbao was lower, beneath the official, but at the end he becomes the god, right? He gives the order to build, so he's the highest on top, he gives the order to a person goes to an elder, an elder builds the temple, and then the people at the lowest ranks build. So definitely, just from looking at the story, you could see the social hierarchy and the social stratification of pre-modern Chinese society. Now, you asked about acceptance. I think when you read the sentence about homophobia of the Qing government, right? So that used to be an old argument that the Qing dynasty government was actively involved in persecuting people who engaged in male-male sexuality. But actually, male-male sexual acts were punished no more harshly than male-female acts. So we don't really know what happened there, right? We don't have the historical context. We know that these two temples, that temple in Fuzhou, they had a licentious cult. There was something in the cult that they didn't like there. Is it male-male sexuality? We're not sure. Maybe it was just the fact that sexuality was worshipped. Because they had an icon, and I'm not sure it's mentioned in your version, but there's an icon of a man holding a younger boy from behind. And then they worshipped that icon in the temple. And they smeared pig intestines on it and all kinds of organs of animals. So, you know, there's also the defiling aspect of it. It sounds for many Chinese people that may be concerned with purity and with morality, it could just be the sexuality and the defiling aspect of use of animal corpses that bothered them. We don't know for sure, but certainly male sexual acts in Qing Dynasty were prosecuted only if they were either rape, child molestations, or part of a context of a major crime, okay, like homicide. They weren't, you know, male people who engaged in homosexual acts were not actively persecuted. If you look at the literary sources, there's abundance of mentions. It was a hallmark of elite status, right? That people from actually elite position were engaged, were having sex with younger boys, or they would become patrons of actors in the opera. Still, that doesn't mean that homosexuality was accepted everywhere, right? We have to remember that people that come from an elite status can have the ability to flout convention and get away with things, right?
Right.
So,
which is even true today, to be honest.
Right. So, yeah. You know, there is this temptation to read all of these literary texts and say, oh my God, you know, all of these aristocrats were just having sex with boys and it was accepted by everyone. But the fact is that if you look at the legal records, sometimes people are imprisoned and or punished. That's because the acts were related to another crime. Maybe there was a robbery or where there was a murder or something. And then somebody actually bothered to report it, and then people would be in prison. Yeah, so we need to think about this carefully, not to too easily draw conclusions about acceptance or tolerance. What really bothered the Qing authorities actually was violations of female chastity. So people who would have sex outside, you know, heterosexual sex outside of marriage were punished severely, right? Because it was seen as the Qing state wanted to strengthen the family unit and tie gender roles closely to normative family roles. So, you know, any sex that breaks apart that harmony was bad, right? So homosexuality, as long as it's on the side, it happens, you know, unofficially, the Qing government never really cared. What happened with this Hutian Bao Temple? We don't know. I mean, yeah. my gut feeling is that the defilement in the temple was probably... But, you know, I'm actually an expert of Japanese religion more than Chinese religion. So I would encourage reading more about it.
I like the part that the authorities had equal treatment for homosexual and heterosexual couples, even if it was in an unofficial capacity. So I guess to a certain extent, there was a sense of fairness and privacy.
And
And the punishment was more so for the crime, like rape, abuse, in this case, peeping, and not necessarily for sexual acts one would participate in with consent.
So, right, and it doesn't impinge on the family unit or hurt in some way. It doesn't become a norm, right? And we're talking about Qing China. In Japan, there's a whole different situation in pre-modern Japan where it was simply happening without any trouble. We can go into that later if we want. But yeah, certainly in China, as long as you weren't raping, child molesting, committing a crime, or somehow destabilizing the family unit, you were fine. Unless somebody really, really hated you and then reported the crime, and then a higher official bothered to actually put you in prison or you know, punish you.
Right.
It wasn't that much of a big deal.
So Japan was a better place to be in if you were queer.
Yeah. So queer, you know, is a modern term. But yeah, basically, yes. In Japan, you had, let's start, you know, in the medieval period, late medieval period, 1400s, 1500s. If you were in the temples, you could have sexual acts with younger boys. The problem is that many of these boys were underage. You know, our norms don't allow that. And it would be wrong to romanticize it. Right. But later on, in the 1600s, 1700s, you have this culture, urban commercial culture, that is secular, right? Where men engage with each other. Again, it's an age-structured, intergenerational relationship. There's always an adult and a youth. And there wasn't really a problem with it, but they have a different structure. When you, let's say you were a youth and you fell in love with an older man, but then at a certain age, you, as a youth, you undergo coming of age ceremony, and then you become the adult. and then you choose whether you have sex with men or women. Many people just established a household and married a woman. So it's just a different construction of, you know, a cultural or social construction of sexuality from our day and age. And those that were exclusively male lovers, they were called the onnagirai, so the women haters. And they were made fun of, actually. Ridiculed in literature. Mm-hmm. It was a very humorous topic for making fun of people. And, you know, authors would use misogynistic jokes. So we really have a different order of sexuality back then. Whether it's better to be there or not, I think modernity, with all of its problems, is certainly better for the, you know, 21st century homosexual, gay, queer, lesbian than any pre-modern period.
Right.
Modernity, yeah, with all of its problems.
Just listening to you, I'm trying to wrap my mind around the social construct around acceptance and tolerance. And I guess every society has societal norms, which seem okay and perfectly fine at that time. But obviously, now we are looking at it from a very objective lens, and even the acceptance somehow doesn't seem that right.
That is why I said that we cannot use the queer or homosexual to that context, right? Because, mm-hmm, you know, homosexuality is a term that was coined in the 19th century, and it assumes a specific identity based on sexual preference. That is almost pathological, right? So it's something that's hardwired to your being as a human being. Mm-hmm. Now, in that Japanese context, is it really something that is carried with you your entire life? No. There would be people that would go one day to, you know, in Tokugawa Japan in the 1600s, 1700s, there would be people that one day would go to a brothel and have sex with female prostitutes. The other day, they would go visit a male kabuki actor. And, you know, sometimes people would do both. Sometimes they would go once to a male kabuki actor and never come back again. So are they gay? Are they queer? It's not the same thing. Yeah. So it's very difficult. That's why you have a lot of people that argue in favor of social constructionism, that sexuality is basically socially and culturally conditioned.
Mm-hmm.
Personally, I wouldn't go as far as that position and say, you know, the society is everything and that's it. I think it's a combination of biological, you know, I'm not a science, but definitely there's something biological, there's societal influence and upbringing, mm-hmm, and then something happens. But certainly society has a decisive influence of what happens in your sexual life. And that's what these cases show.
That's where the spectrums come, right? Like in this case, bisexuality or just experimenting. And I think society has influence on the acceptance part. And
growing up, if you see a lot of examples, that kind of gives you more confidence in expressing your sexuality or in whatever way you want to.
So society has influence on acceptance, and that in turn is related to coming to terms and embracing that lifestyle or your true self.
Right, for sure.
So we are talking about different countries and cultures, and I guess religion in general, both in the West and the East, has long pushed the homosexual community into the margin. But I don't think any religion would preach unfairness or discrimination. So do you think there is a government propaganda or the powerful society leaders change the narrative of the original religious texts?
Just because the religion is part of the government to a certain extent?
Yeah, that's interesting. I think certainly in the case of the Qing, for example, they had a Confucian or Neo-Confucian ethos that they followed. So at one point, actually, homosexuality was banned during the Qing era for a short time, but it was really just sort of an afterthought that came from Neo-Confucianism. But I think, historically speaking, the state overwhelmingly prevails over religion at a certain point. And then you have other social mores and considerations. For example, with the advent of modernity, you have a scientific discourse, right? Governments are trying to become rational. You know, in China and Japan, they all of a sudden get this flow of scientific discourse from the West. And then they read about homosexuality and they start learning new things. That's actually when homosexuality becomes criminalized or a problem in a more meaningful way. So we have in the story an example of a temple that's been persecuted and destroyed. But you see, it is the secular officials that destroy it, not necessarily right. another religion. So here, actually, the religion that embraces homosexuality is victimized, right? Hmm. But you know, when modern biomedical science and psychiatry enters China and Japan, they start reading about homosexuals as deviants, unhealthy, abnormal. And I think this starts penetrating very deeply to both popular discussions and religions as well. Mm-hmm. And we feel it until this day. So if you now ask me why we don't have this openly male-male sexual culture in Japan that we used to have in the Edo period, this has to do partly with westernizing influence, where mm-hmm. Japanese state officials, scientists read this material and started pathologizing homosexuality. So I actually see the danger coming more from the secular authority than religion itself in East Asia.
And with East Asia, I will extend that to Southeast Asia, because India, which at that time included the neighboring countries, had a more open attitude to homosexuality before the British colonization. And there is ample evidence of it in ancient and medieval history. Same-sex relationships were only criminalized when we got colonized by the British.
Right, yeah, they are often blamed for that. Something similar happened in India where, you know, Western power, actually, you were, you know, India was colonized, so which is even worse than just reading text coming from the West, right?
Right.
So, and then you have this laws of sodomy that are imported from Britain, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that had a devastating effect for sure.
Mm-hmm.
So there is openness to sexuality in India a lot throughout history, right?
Right. Whether ancient or medieval India, fluid sexuality was present in the society. One can see depictions of homosexuality in temple imagery, sculptures, sacred narrative, and religious scriptures, explaining the presence of homosexuality in Hinduism. Even under Muslim rule, there are written narratives and depiction of homosexuality in Mughal chronicles about Babur, who founded the Mughal dynasty, Alauddin Khilji's son, Mubarak. In Hinduism, there are temples of Khajuraho, Sun Temple, caves of Ajanta and Ellora. And like you said, sexuality is a big part of Hinduism. Everyone knows about Kama Sutra, by the way, which also has a complete chapter on homosexuality. So after British colonization, they brought their own rules to India, including criminalization of homosexuality, even though it didn't conform to India's attitude towards homosexuality. It was more to do with their Christian belief system. In 2018, Supreme Court of India decriminalized homosexuality and stated that history owes apology to the LGBTQ community and their families, recognizing homosexuality as a natural part of human sexuality. So even though the court's decision has taken India back to its roots, it will take time to change society's attitude towards something they grew up thinking as wrong.
Where consent is the only thing society cares about. And if it's between consenting adults, it's okay, it's cool. So I guess we'll see if we can live to see that day.
Hopefully.
Right?
Yeah, hopefully.
So coming back to the story, the title is Rabbit God, and the slang term for homosexuals in the late imperial China was toots, which is translated to bunnies. Do you think there is any association?
Yeah, that's a great question. So this term toots, there is much speculation about it. To be frank, there is no clear convincing explanation for why it became a slang in Qing Dynasty. It was a very insulting term, by the way, that applied mm-hmm. only to a penetrated sexual partner, not a penetrator. So actually in China, the penetrated was seen as feminine and it was the more unequal part of the equation. Whereas in Japan, it wasn't like that. In Japan, the recipient of anal sex was not deemed inferior. But anyway, so the term carries a strong feminized connotation. And it is something like today's sissy or a wuss, but actually much stronger, like the F word.
Mm-hmm.
So You know, there is the transcultural character of the rabbit as a horny, as a fertile and full of sexual vitality. You can see that in ancient Greece and Christianity. And actually in ancient Rome, the rabbit was connected to homosexuality. So that's an even more clear connection, transculturally speaking. But if you ask Japanese people what they think about rabbits today, they'll tell you that they are kawaii, which means cute. So now in Japan, the rabbit is completely desexualized. That it's just a cute thing.
Hmm.
But if you Google the tuarshan, the gay rabbit from your story today, on on Chinese websites, you see on social media and the internet, they say that the moon rabbit is called Tuarye, which is another name, but they say that he's a protector of male prostitutes. So basically these two have been conflated, even though they are entirely unconnected with each other.
Isn't there Year of Rabbit in Chinese calendar?
There is. Yeah, there is. So it's an important animal in astrological sense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you know, in the old Chinese and Japanese the scheduling system, you have also the hour of the rabbit. But to say that there is some sort of connection between that rabbit and the rabbit here, I don't think so.
Right.
The bottom line is that the story from Yu and Mei's version that you've read is the only one that mentions the rabbit, that Hu Tianbao is a rabbit, because of this kind of stereotype of the Tuzi as being a feminized person that engages in male sexual acts.
Right.
But the Hu Tianbao cult that you have in Taiwan today, that's entirely new. It's an invented tradition. So it harkens back to this myth we're talking about today, but there is no direct linear line to the Fujian cult, to the temples in Fuzhou. It has no actual links with it. Yeah, they just, you know, they love the story, they love the myth, and they decided to revive it, which is very interesting, because now you have a cult of a gay rabbit god, right, in Taiwan.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And just to touch on something you said, and probably a different tangent, I find it quite problematic that femininity attributed to you was considered as being inferior.
Oh yeah, for sure.
So not necessarily a tangent, but intersectional might be a better word.
Yeah, pre-modern culture all over the world is androcentric, right? It centers on men, and it's also misogynist. It's hateful of women.
Right.
So a lot of feminine attributes were seen as signs of weakness.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, the whole terminology that is used in Japan in the early modern period, actually in China too. So how do you say male sexuality? You say nansi or nanshoku, which literally means male callers. So you have male callers and you have another word, female callers. You would expect that female callers would be lesbianism, but it's not.
Yeah.
So it replaces the object of desire with women. So the subject is still male. So this is the attraction to women when you are a male. That's female caller. So the female perspective is completely out of the question here.
Wow.
This needs to be exposed and then problematized and deconstructed, right?
And that's what we are doing here. Explore, problematize, and deconstruct. I think that was a perfect end to our discussion. I want to thank you for coming on the show and bringing so much insight and knowledge.
Oh, sure. It was a pleasure.
And today is the last day of Pride Month, so happy Pride.
Yeah, happy Pride.
All year round and not just the month of June.
Yeah, of course.
On that note, bye for now.
Bye-bye.
Let me know your thoughts on the story and our discussion by emailing me on woketalespodcast@gmail.com or through social media at woketalespodcast on Instagram and woketalespod on Twitter. And please rate, review, and like Woketales Podcast, and don't forget to subscribe so you can easily access our weekly stories. If you have any story recommendations or if you want to come dissect and analyze a story with me, give me a shout out on email or social media. Because whatever you do, keep dissecting and keep analyzing.